Hi, I'm Max Chilton, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 833, May 26th, 2020. Nasser?
Thank you, sir. British Grand Prix may go mushy peas. Hungarian goulash may save the day. And now back to Gordon Ramsay of podcasting.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Vettel going to Mercedes. Maybe not. Hamlin loses ballast on track, laughing out loud. We have Loosh on the loose with a book review. We got Gary Sloan, who's groaning and moaning with his problems. And we have Tech Talk with Tim discussing the new budget caps. And with all that going on, we have part one, the vintage Nigel Mansell interview. That's right, El Leone, right here on this podcast, number 833. And just a reminder, we need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly Familia tab. You know you want to. Nas, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Very good, sir. Thank you. Normally, when we have such a program, we call it Fully Loaded In-Flight Burrito. But since we have Arnige, I think it's a case of Fully Loaded Bangers and Mash.
Keep up the good work, Nasser. Bangers and Mash, Bubbles and Squeak, everything. I think there's some kidney pudding in here. It's outstanding.
We shall start with some good news, sir. There is peace in our lifetime in Formula One. Teams voted to accept a plan to lower the budget cap to be introduced next year by $30 million to $145 million, which is about 114 quid in England. This is very surprising. It will be reduced again to $140 million in 2022 and $135 million for the period 2023 to 2025. With this kind of scale, we might even see Junior Johnson enter a team in Formula One. If we were not in this difficult time, I don't think we would reach this milestone so quickly, as different teams have different agendas, all centered on their own benefit and not for the good of the sport. Do you think, sir? And I also read some news. I did not go into details because it was on ItaliaRacing.net. They may go away with the MGU part of the hybrid system in 2025, which apparently is the most complex system, and hopefully it will bring in new manufacturers. What say you, senor?
I think these caps are dreams. They're dreams in a can, and this can will not be opened. I think that these caps look great on paper. I don't see Ferrari or Mercedes dealing with such a small cap. I mean, it's going to change everything, and we haven't seen anything yet. Please, stay tuned for more, but these are not going to hold up. Trust me.
Yes, but keep in mind, this is not the complete budget of the F1 team in its totality. My understanding is the driver's salaries and marketing, a lot of stuff is still VAT, value-added tax kind of deal that they may have. You know, the big companies will always find big money to spend. So I agree with you that they were not going to be able to control anything and everything. The haves will have more and the have-nots will have less, as long as there are the Strolls and the Tiffies and the Daimler Benz of the world out there. So I have to feel sorry for the sorry guys like Renault.
Yeah, I would feel sorry for Renault, especially when they announce that they need to cut $2 billion in costs. When you're cutting $2 billion with a B in costs, it's going to affect your Formula One program. I guarantee it.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing that's going against them, their alliance with Nissan is not going really gung-ho. Actually, there was a news item yesterday, I believe, that Renault and Nissan have decided not to proceed with the merger plans they have, but they will try to sort of repair the alliance that got shaken by Mr. Carlos Ghosn slipping into a musical box. But I think Renault's another problem is, obviously because of the virus, car sales are hurting very badly, but the Cyril Abitbol program, not blaming him, but that has not been a big success. It's not that they have won a several pole. It's not like the Renault of the 80s where the cars were supremely quick. They were always on pole and would lead races, just would not win a lot of races. But this program is, you know, even Daniel Ricciardo is saying, oh, wow, after two seasons, and that's not a good statement for this team or any top team.
I agree.
Okay, sir, you know, this past weekend was the Memorial Day weekend. I never could even imagine that I would see this kind of a day in my life. No Indy 500 and no Grand Prix in Monte Carlo. Good news is, at least the Indy will happen later in the year under new management of Mr. Roger Penske. And more good news is, this is very exciting, next year the two will not take place on the same weekend. So I'm very happy about that. Moving on to the F1 season this year, Mr. Rogers, it was looking good a week ago that round 3 and 4 will take place at Silverstone, but then the UK government plan was to have a 2-week quarantine when the borders open. I'm assuming Chase Carey's private jet must be taking off daily looking for venues. How things have changed. Tracks like Hockenheimring and Hungaroring are asking Liberty Media to show me the money if spectators are not allowed. You know, misery loves company. Mugello Circuit, owned by Ferrari and located in beautiful Tuscany part of Italy, is ready to replace Monza, and Imola is also interested in hosting an F1 race this year. But the latest news is, which came out today, I believe, is that the British government have agreed to not impose the quarantine on the Formula One staff. So maybe the British Grand Prix will take place, and I hope it does. Silverstone is a great historical place, and who would not want two Formula One races at that circuit in 1 year? I just hope we don't have a second coming of the virus, which is really my big concern, once the lockdown is totally lifted on a global scale. That will really put Agent Orange on the season. And here, I'm not talking Army of Max fans. All we need is 8 races to have a championship. Now, there are some reports from Texas that US Grand Prix may not be possible because of the virus and restrictions there. And things are not getting any better in Land of Samba, Brazil. I say get the minimum 8 races as soon as it can be done by doing double headers at the rings in Austria, Germany, and Hungary, and 2 at one of the historical autodromos in Italia. Then we can dream away to races in faraway lands if need be. Do you have concerns that we may have a few races and then the coronavirus returns?
No, I think everybody's doing a good job with shelter in place. Even though it's a spike can arrive and it could be part of our reality, I'm betting on the happy side of life. And so therefore, I'm going with Fernando for the championship.
Now, is the flames open again in California or San Jose?
No, they are not. They have closed and no restaurants are open.
Hi, I'm Max Chilton and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
The outer Bay Area are different. And right now, the Bay Area is separate from the rest of California.
Okay. Next, we move on to DC Declaration. David Coulthard has come out with his opinion on Mercedes taking on Sebastian Vettel in 2021. And this is what he said, and I quote, "In Lewis, they've got someone who can win Grand Prix and championships. to bring Seb in there because you think that will raise Lewis's game, it's very difficult. If you look at these exceptional performances in sport, serial winners, I don't think he needs the friction of a four-time world champion to get the best out of him. I think Vettel could be disruptive to the team, end of quote. What say you, sir?
I think the total opposite. German, going to a German team, very settling. All of a sudden, Lewis Hamilton, all of a sudden you catch him looking at Babbel.com trying to learn German with his doll of Niki Lauda sitting next to him. So I don't know, but I like the concept of Vettel going to Mercedes, even though I know it's not going to happen. Let's hear from Gary Sloan, and he's talking about DC.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to this week's edition of In the Pit Lane. My name's Gary Sloan, and this week we're going to look at Formula One as it enters, arguably, its most challenging time in its history, with the big question posed, does Formula One have the right leadership? Well, Liberty Media will have to navigate troubled waters over the next few months, and at its helm will be Chase Carey. Now, Chase has come under fire for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, especially the debacle that was the Australian Grand Prix. Although it's quite easy to be an armchair critic, and to be fair to Chase and Liberty, they are dealing with an unprecedented situation, and like governments around the world, they're not always getting it right. Hindsight's a wonderful thing. But what Chase and Liberty should do is recognise their shortcomings, and in everyone's interests, appoint a new chief executive with the relevant skill set and experience to deal with the challenges ahead. No better man for the job than one Mr. David Coulthard, a.k.a. DC. Let's look at why DC is uniquely qualified for this role. Well, first and foremost, he's a racer at heart with a true love and passion for motor racing. With a successful F1 career at Williams, McLaren and Red Bull, DC knows what makes drivers and teams tick. He's also a successful businessman with a range of interests including luxury hotels and TV production. Media is a strong point for DC with his commentary and presenting roles in the UK, firstly with the BBC and latterly with Channel 4. DC knows the business from the other side of the camera, as he's co-founder of Whisper Films, who produce many sports coverage, including Channel 4's F1. In a testament to the company, Sony Pictures Television has recently invested in the Whisper Group. When it comes to the sponsorship side of the business, DC is weekly at home, as he is the co-founder of Velocity Experiences, a brand experience agency working in motorsport. One of its coups was to deliver Formula One's live London event in 2017. Doesn't stop there. DC is also a brand ambassador for companies like Mercedes, Red Bull Racing, Heineken, Hugo Boss, UBS, Wings for Life, IWC, Transcal, Cooper, and so it goes on. So the man knows a thing or two about the sponsors. When it comes to circuits, DC is president of the British Racing Drivers Club. Now, this club is the company that owns and operates the Silverstone Circuit, which of course hosts the British Grand Prix. Doesn't end there. His expertise expands to other racing series, with DC being a spokesperson, co-commentator and advisory board member of the W Series. He's also been involved with Formula E as a commentator. So if you look at all the parts of Formula One's ecosystem, the teams, sponsors, broadcasters, circuits, DC covers all bases. He's one of the most connected and respected individuals in Formula One, with a broad skill set and experience that's required. Is it likely, and would he be interested? Well, it was rumoured Liberty last year was trying to poach Toto Wolff to run the show, but Ferrari, as Ferrari tend to have a habit of doing, vetoed the move. I don't think there would be any such opposition to DC, and I would speculate all the different stakeholders in Formula One would back the move. This could be a wise strategy for Liberty to protect their F1 investment, and I'm sure the person who thought all their Christmas had come at once would be Ross Brawn. As for DC's motivation, well, he could establish himself in the role and guide Formula One to whatever future shape it may take. And then as an individual wealthy investor, he could lead a management buyout and actually purchase F1 from Liberty Media. So go on, Liberty, for all our sakes, ditch the ego and appoint DC, toot sweet. On a footnote, maybe DC's greatest achievement to date is not winning 13 Grand Prix, but his ownership of the Brown Dog Pub. Well, that's it for another week. My book, In the Pit Lane, F1 Exposed, is available at all good online retailers. Till next week, stay safe and stay well. Hello, listeners. My name is Gary Sloan, and this is this week's In the Pit Lane. Well, among all the shenanigans in the driver's market, the big question remains, where does Sebastian Vettel go, or does he retire? Well, here's the thing. Crazy idea that is, I think he should go to Williams. That's right, George Russell will move to Mercedes to partner Hamilton. Vettel goes to Williams. What a great boost for the team. Mercedes would love it, with the Williams with their engine in it. For Vettel, well, he's nothing to lose. Why does he want to spend maybe a swan song of his career in a midfield team going nowhere? Why not race for the back and show us all what he's really capable of and why he won the four world champions? There we go. There's the idea for the week. Until next week, stay safe, stay well.
Yeah, but you know what I was thinking the other day? If there was such a lot of brouhaha in the German press, where they kind of like pretty much corner Mercedes, Daimler, Benz in a situation that you have to give our homeboy a chance, then they may do that just to save face. But I think, you know, we've seen this too many times. Two tigers in a cage does not work. And, you know, I, as much as I would like to see Seb or Max at Mercedes as teammate to Lewis, I have to agree with David that rattling the cage off your golden goose Goliath, not a smart idea. Not too long ago, and I think you remember this, it cost a team $100 million. And talking of big money, we come to, brother, can you spare me a dime? May 29 could be the day that lives in F1 infamy. Renault is set to announce a cost-saving plan of what you already mentioned, $2 billion, that may result in closing few factories in France, which is not going down very well in your Shangri-La. We have to see if the guillotine will also fall on the Grand Prix team. Last week, they accepted a $5 billion loan from the French government. Les politicians already have a 15% stake in Renault, which is the French government stake. And my understanding is the check has been approved, but not yet in the mail. And I already mentioned that they're having issues with their merger plans with Nissan. And just as a business note, apart from having a stake in Nissan and Mitsubishi, Renault also owns fantastic car company called Dacia of Romania and has a joint venture in Russia, which used to be the old Fiat factory in Toliati. So they are very huge on a global scale, but you know, as they say, the higher you fly, the harder you fall. And we don't want to see anybody fall or leave Formula One, but we have to sooner or later face the reality of racing and the financial situation in today's world. Next, sir, Aston Martin news. CEO Andy Palmer is to be replaced by AMG boss Tobias Moers. Toto recently invested in Aston Martin, and at one time he was a shareholder in AMG. I'm not 100% sure, but I think AMG is now totally owned by Mercedes-Benz. And when Toto announced that he was investing a lot of money in the Aston Martin company, I just had a feeling that there will be some shake-up in the management, because Toto has done very well in terms of managing businesses, and that's why he is doing such a great job as the Der Führer at the Formula One team. Now we come to, everybody has an opinion in this day and age, as they should. So we come to Minardi and his mantra. The man who gave Alonso his first ride in Formula One expressed his opinion on Take 3 at Renault. In an interview with Italian magazine Autosprint, Signor Giancarlo Minardi said, and I quote, he has already made some wrong choices, such as McLaren or leaving Ferrari. The doors of the top teams are closed. There is no guarantee with Renault. I think it is better to do something else and keep his image as an all-round driver high. Otherwise, he could ruin it. End of quote. And did I hear the other day, sir, that Alonso had won the virtual Indy 500? Is that correct?
That is correct. Alonso is El Machismo, remember?
No, that he always was. But I'm surprised you did not start the program today by jumping, you know, and yelling and screaming, Papa got a brand new bag.
It's all part of my therapy with my therapist to slowly tone down the Fernando Machismo of the world syndrome. And so I am following his directions. and therefore less Fernando is better for the host of F1Weekly.com.
Sounds like your therapist is also a listener of F1 Weekly.
Indeed. Now we've got Loosh on the loose with a book review.
Hello, F1 Weekly. This is Lucien Byfield with Loosh on the loose. Today, I'm going to review a highly anticipated new motorsport book. Niki Lauda, The Biography, is the new book released by Maurice Hamilton, telling the story of the great Austrian triple world champion who passed away just last year. Wow, it's a year already. I purchased the audiobook version of this release, which is unabridged, so nothing is missing from the paperback version. I must say that when I pre-ordered this book a few months ago, I couldn't wait to receive it. Time and again, I would double-check the release date and counted the days. While being a fantastic read, certain passionate motorsport fans may not find this book that enlightening. I am sad to say this, but I do feel that Maurice pretty much captured about 80% of what any reasonably knowledgeable fan of Niki Lauda would already know. But in saying that, there were still some fantastic anecdotes and mini treasures to be found, especially in the latter part of the book when Niki was heavily involved with the Mercedes Petronas Formula One team as non-executive chairman. Many years ago, I read To Hell and Back, the original Niki Lauda biography, and while that is a great book, and still worthy of a read today, it is massively out of date and understandably does not cover a lot of the latter years of Niki's life, up to and including his death at the relatively surprising age of 70. So, with that in mind, the new book is an absolute must, as it will fill in the missing years and reveal subtle shifts in Niki's personality, family relationship dynamics, and other business ventures. The most notably disappointing aspect of this book for me is the absence of any substantial information about Niki Lauda's formative years. His childhood is not featured at all, and the negative family reactions he received regarding his life choice to go motor racing, well, they are minimal at best. However, some readers may like this. Maurice might have pulled off a masterstroke in leaving it out. Compare this with Murray Walker's biography, and at times, there was just not enough Formula One to keep you interested unless you wanted the big picture. Whilst this offering is primarily about the motor racing career of Niki Lauda, Maurice didn't neglect to include the business side of his life with Lauda Air. Niki's career as a pilot and entrepreneur are well documented and balanced. Another point to note about the way Maurice has written this book is that it is almost strictly chronological. This can make the story too predictable, especially when the reader is already familiar with the career path that the super rat took. But most biographies stick to this tried and tested format. For me, I do prefer themes that intertwine back and forth, and thankfully, many of the guest contributors' anecdotes do add this variation to the timeline. As an audiobook, I was really impressed with narrator Andrew Wincott and his use of multiple accents. He has a fantastic voice, making for an enjoyable listening experience. Whilst Wincott can certainly produce foreign inflected English accents like a superstar, it has to be said that not one of his accents sounded remotely like the characters he was portraying. Had this been a work of fiction, the accents would have been absolutely perfect, and to a relatively new fan of Formula One, it won't be a problem at all. To hear the various drivers, team personnel and the like being portrayed with generic accents was quite off-putting at times. For instance, was Alain Prost French or German? At times, you would be forgiven for getting confused. Clive James sounded like an exaggerated Aussie, nothing like the late great orator that he was. And as for the voice of Niki, well, I'll let you be the judge if you choose the audio version. I am glad I bought this book, and I will definitely listen to it again. But I must say, despite being a fan of Maurice Hamilton and many of his previous works, this book felt a bit too safe and respectful at times, however understandable that might be in light of how recently the world lost Niki. Had this book been written less affectionately, we might have been given a more revealing book like the Steve Jobs exclusive biography by Walter Isaacson. I'm not trying to say that Niki is painted as a saint, but there were definitely certain aspects of his private life missing, notably family life struggles and partying shenanigans that today would be frowned upon. Mark Webber and Jenson Button's biographies were similarly safe. I highly recommend this book. It may sound like I'm not giving it much credit, But anyone who has read any of Maurice Hamilton's books will know that the quality will be of a high standard no matter what he writes about. I just feel it could have been a bit more imaginative and comprehensive, and a little less safe. After all, Nicky did make his fame in an era when sex was safe and the driving was dangerous.
And next, our favorite, Tech Talk with Tim.
Hello, race fans. I hope you're safe and healthy out there. As I'm sure you're aware, the F1 season has not started yet. F1 is looking to provide some amount of racing in the 2020 season, whether with or without fans present at the tracks, as well as make changes affecting this and the next season to ease the financial stresses. So let's talk about those changes. The projected 2020 calendar is constantly changing and will certainly change again, so I'll leave that discussion to Clark and Nasser. But behind the scenes, engineers and teams are still working to prepare themselves to be competitive whenever racing does begin. Without televised races, there's no return on investment for sponsors, so money is tight. So the teams have agreed to some cost-cutting measures that will affect whatever becomes of the 2020 season, as well as the 2021 season. In general, cost-cutting measures have continued to become more stringent throughout the years, so not all of the changes are necessarily a direct result of the 2020 circumstances. There's a real balance to strike here. Some teams, like McLaren, are hoping to put a strict cost cap on team budgets for 2021 to help make recovering to financial stability easier. So it seems like cost-cutting is the responsible thing to do, right? Well, Ferrari also makes a good point that smaller budgets will make it impossible for them to keep their full staff employed, so they would need to lay off more employees with a strict cost cap. So even putting racing aside for a moment, there's no simple answer as to the question of what's best for the people of F1. What has been agreed to is the following. In 2021, teams will cut their budgets by 17% to $145 million. Budgets will continue to slowly decrease thereafter. Wind tunnel test time will be restricted according to 2019 performance, with the more successful teams being more highly restricted. This should help even the playing field. Keep in mind, wind tunnel testing typically costs a few thousand dollars per hour, and that assumes teams already have access to a facility that itself costs tens of millions of dollars. 2020 cars will now be run in 2021. Now, development work on a car is constantly continuing, so the cars may evolve between the years, but they won't be completely brand new. This also means that there will be a delay of the massive technical rule changes that were scheduled for 2021. Now they'll be moving to 2022. I haven't discussed these upcoming technical changes much, but be aware that they are on the horizon. F1 cars haven't seen such a radical set of changes since 2009, when the cars ditched their low and wide rear wings for the modern high and narrow ones. The 2022 cars now will look radically different, with the primary objective being more frequent overtaking by changing the way a leading car negatively impacts a trailing car's oncoming airflow. So there are a lot of changes happening, and surely more to come. This isn't new news, but it was nice to see that F1 teams have been using their design and manufacturing capabilities to facilitate ventilator development. So that's a nice offshoot of the investment the teams have made into R&D. So until next time, please stay safe and healthy.
Okay, sir, man, this I had to sit down to and read it a few times. I don't know how you feel about this. Shock driver signing in the beyond silly season. This cannot happen in the regular silly season. This is beyond silly season. The 2020 F1 season has not even started, and we already have high-profile driver signings and departure. This may surprise some fans out there. Hang on to your hollyhocks, as Derek Daly would say. Racing Point has confirmed Sergio Perez's teammate in 2021 will be Lance Stroll. Wow. I am impressed. I just wonder how the negotiation went. Daddy, only $5 million? I think I'm worth $10 million. And Daddy goes, Mommy thinks you are worth $15 million, so we will settle for $20 million. Must be nice and enjoy the ride. Are you surprised at this signing, sir?
I laughed and laughed and laughed. It's not even worth mentioning, but you want to mention to the whole world that, yes, you have a paid driver. Yes, he's the owner of the team, his papa. And yes, it's all about deep pockets and money and papa. Formula One stands for papa and the baby who will become a new Formula One driver.
Yes, and I think next year when they are rebranded as Aston Martin, I think they're going to run in British Racing Green. a maple leaf on a British Racing green car is going to look very, what you would call, outstanding. Next, we come to Striker Pose. Charles Leclerc is now a brand ambassador for Armani. He tweeted saying, "Fashion together with music and motorsports have always been my passion, and to be representing such an iconic brand from now on is a huge honor." Yes, absolutely. Who wouldn't look good in a Ferrari racing suit and in an Armani suit once he's out of the cockpit? Signor Giorgio Armani said, and I quote, "He is fresh-faced and has an energetic physical presence that my made-to-measure collection enhances and matches well." End of quote. On the other hand, times and things change and circumstances change. I think Men's Warehouse should sign Sebastian Vettel and start a new ad campaign with four-time world champion saying, "I will not race a red car next season. I guarantee that." Any comments from you, sir?
Excellent job, sir. Not only that, but he's not only a supporter, he's also a client.
Now we come to flack from Flavio. According to the Benetton Swami, Carlos Sainz Jr. will... This guy is something. He's saying Carlos Sainz Jr. will be numero dos at Ferrari. Briatore explained his agenda by saying, and I quote, "For me, the winning recipe is always to have a driver for the title and a driver who scores a lot of points and takes them away from the opponents." End of quote. This is what I call the Nando Fisico rule. Racing reality is very simple. Regardless of what the contract says, team will gradually slide to the driver with more speed, as Seb found out at Scuderia. This was also learned the hard way by the professor in 1988. Now we move to Singapore Firecracker. The promoters of the race have said, no fans, no F1. Last year's race on the Marina Bay circuit was watched by 268,000 spectators over the three-day period, with overseas visitors making up 40% of the crowd. Now check this out. This is a street race, Formula One race in Singapore. 3 day, 268,000 people came. Barefoot servants too. More people go to the Indy 500 on Sunday than this 3 day event. Isn't that impressive how big the Indy 500 is?
Yes, the Indy 500 is definitely testicular.
Yes, you know, it's going to be happening in August and September. Man, I really, really need a racing fix. And I tell you what, the IMSA sports car season will resume at Daytona on July 4th with a 2-hour, 40-minute race. And 2 weeks later, they will be at Sebring. And I will try, if possible, to attend both events. And I'm seriously thinking of at least going to the Indy 500 to get some racing fix. Because, you know, if the US Grand Prix is canceled, that will be a complete disaster as far as watching Formula One cars in person is concerned. Next, dishes are done. This is interesting. Dishes are done for Daniel. Formula E driver Daniel Abt was disqualified and ordered to pay £8,900, which is about $10,000, to charity for getting a professional gamer to compete under his name in an official esports race. Stoffel Vandoorne and Jean-Eric Wyn suspected that the German was not at the wheel or whatever it is called in e-gaming and requested the driver to turn his video. So Daniel got busted, and he's singing our favorite song, "I'm Sorry."
I'm sorry. Sorry.
But the real bad news is that he has been dropped by the Audi Formula E team, the real racing team, which is interesting. The Audi team in Formula E is ran by his family concern, Abt Racing. So a little sad there. And he's a very nice kid. I've met him a few times. We have interviewed him in the past. So I feel bad for him. And, you know, we're all human. So what do you expect? Now we come to famous last words. They come from 1978 world champion Mario Andretti, who took the crown driving for Lotus team owner. And this is what he had to say about Colin Chapman. And I quote, "Working with Chapman was no trip to Paris, but I guess you're always going to have problems with the genius, right? He was such a maverick." End of quote. Colin Chapman, great innovator, great contribution in the world of motor racing, but definitely, you know, not everybody's cup of tea.
Keep up the good work, Nass.
Sir, before you get Nigel Mansell in the green room, I just would personally like to thank Gary, Lush on the Loose, and Tech Talk for their contribution. It is greatly, greatly appreciated, and we are very, very thankful.
We have a special interview, what we call the Machismo interview, and of course, none other than former world champion Nigel Mansell. Nass, this man probably needs no introduction, but let's introduce him anyway.
Yeah, thank you. Well, what happened here, about a week ago, I found out that the Atlantics were testing here, and I knew that the Mansell boys are in Atlantics. So I said, you know, if the kids are here, Papito might be here too. So I contacted Miss Elizabeth Cannon, who is the PR lady for Walker Racing, and she confirmed that he plans to be there. So, and she couldn't make it, so I was there, of course, I took a day off on Monday. And so this conversation took place on March 10th, 2008, that's for the record, at Laguna Seca. And it was very nice. You know, good thing was there were not many people, so he gave me a lot of time. So we're going to put this thing in two parts. First part is today, and then, you know, following week will be the second part. And I was able to talk to him, basically. And, you know, a lot of things were happening with Mansell in his career. I mean, there was drama and, you know, he's leading a race, he's leading the world championship, tire blows up, he's waving to the crowd, and, you know, car stops on the final lap, the duels he had with Ayrton Senna. I was able to get in all of those questions, and it was very nice and kind of him to explain a lot of things, what the facts were, because, you know, a lot of time you read stuff, it may not be exactly what happened there. So I would like to thank him very much for taking the time and sitting down with me. And an interesting thing happened. He started listening in the middle of our conversation. And as I said, what's going on here? He says, I got to get a cup of tea here. So a brief you know, look back on his career. He was British Formula Ford 1600 champion, 1977. He was second in the Formula 3 championship in 1979. And, of course, Formula 1 world champion 1992. After finishing second three times, 1986, 1987, and in 1991, and he was car champion in his rookie year, 1993. And he is very proud of the fact that he's the only driver in motor racing history to hold two top-tier titles at the same time across the pond, which is very, very impressive. In Grand Prix wins, he is the most successful British driver of all time with 31 victories, which puts him in fourth on the all-time list. His first win came in 1985 at Brands Hatch, a European Grand Prix driving for Honda-powered Williams. And his final win was in Australia in 1994 for the same team, but this time powered by?
Oh, no.
Thank you. And in 1986 and 1992, he received the BBC Sports Personality of the Year Award. And I have to say this, I cannot think of any racing driver who became world champion where he went through so much of hurdles and setbacks. I mean, this is an incredible story.
And lots of controversy. He was, people loved to hate Nigel Mansell. He was outspoken, yeah, and he was brash and demanding at teams, you know.
Yeah.
He thought he was a prima donna, you know, the Jesus. So he's a very interesting character.
Yeah, and you know, he talks about, I mean, he made a very interesting comment that some drivers, not all racing drivers are racing drivers. Some are more like drivers. And it's interesting the names he takes, some very big names, he considers them as drivers. And also, you know, his rivalry with Nelson Piquet and what Mario Andretti was not very complimentary towards him recently. So I was able to bring up all those issues, and it was very nice that he answered all those things instead of telling me, okay, it's over now, like you are doing right now.
So keep up the good work. And now, an interview with Nigel Mansell.
Okay, I'm at Laguna Seca with 1992 world champion Mr. Excitement Nigel Mansell. Nigel, welcome back to California, and how are you today, sir?
Very, very good. It's we've had three climates here. We've had beautiful sunshine, it was too hot this morning, and then just perfect conditions lunchtime, and then very cold this afternoon.
But it never rains in California.
No, it snows though.
Very true. Okay, first I want to ask a little bit about your kids. Leo and Greg are now competing in the U.S. Why the shift from the European scene to the U.S.?
I think for a change in the way racing is done. It's a great learning curve coming over to new circuits, going around circuits, for instance, anti-clockwise as opposed to clockwise all the time. And the Atlantic series is a very good, very strong series, has more horsepower than Formula 3, has the tunnel under the car, so it has a lot more ground effect. They pull over 4G, and it's a stepping stone to something bigger, hopefully, in the future.
Now, recently, a mothership, Champcar, filed bankruptcy. Is that a concern for you? Do you have a plan B?
I think short-term, it's a difficult transition. But mid-term, long-term, I think it's the best thing for open-wheel racing in America. And if you had a one, you'd like to pull them together a lot sooner than now. But I think it's a positive thing for the future. And, you know, I think there'll just be a settling down period, and then things will be, as I said, better.
Both your kids have competed in Formula BMW and Formula 3 in UK. What are the expectations in Atlantics this year?
I think we come with an expectation of a hard year, learning all the circuits, learning a new car, a new team, a new formula. But we hope that there'll be some race meetings. We'll be able to demonstrate that, you know, both the boys are competent drivers and quite quick. Greg, as you know, has had podiums in England, in Europe with Formula 3. Leo was going very well this afternoon until there was a slight problem coming out of the last turn, but we're optimistic that we can hopefully have a solid year.
Okay. How involved are you in guiding and managing their career?
I'd say very much so at the moment, although they're totally their own people. They make their own decisions. They're directors of Mansell Motorsport. You know, we work as a team. Just like Walker Racing is a team, Mansell Motorsport is a unique little team.
Now, I noticed both your sons race in the same series, same team. Is that important for you that they race in the same team?
At the moment, I think it's very healthy and very good. I think as they progress, I think obviously it probably won't be possible for them to be in the same team, but I don't see that a problem either. So whatever and wherever it takes them, I think will be fine with me as long as they're happy and comfortable and competing and doing what they want to do.
Now, Britain has produced more world champions than any other nation. How old were you when you developed an interest, and was there any racing interest in your family?
No, there wasn't, and my racing interest started when I was 7 or 8 years of age. And this is what's incredible with my two boys. They only started racing 2.5, 3 years ago. So they're very green under the gills, and they have a lot to learn. But, you know, their potential is quite enormous, and what they're doing with the experience they have is a great credit to them.
Are you trying to tell me they did not pay attention to Dad's career?
No, we didn't pay attention to them wanting to go racing. We were hoping they were going to be golfers. They're both basically scratch golfers, and we were hoping they were going to go the professional golf route. But we lost that one.
And can you tell us about your karting career, and how important is karting to a career in motor racing?
I think karting is very important, and as you know, we have Mansell Raceway in England, which is a kart track at Dunkerswell in the southwest of England. And we still race, all three of us now, in karting. Even though they're doing this, we go and have some fun in the national events. But it's the breeding ground of future, I think, world champions. And I think when you look at how many world champions started their career in karting, it's a very, very important grassroots sport.
Now, you were the most tenacious fighter in Formula One. How tenacious were you in fighting the Cancel-Mansell scheme they had going?
Yeah, we're going to court now in England with noise abatement. It seems to be the way of the world at the moment. Everybody complains about the noise. And we're going to the high courts now to fight it, hopefully. And we will win, because the racetrack is on the side of an airport. The one runway is only 40 yards away from our pits. So, you know, it's a crazy situation. But unfortunately, you know, we've got to go through the process now, and hopefully we'll come out where we can still go racing.
Great. You were 1977 Formula 4 champion in UK, and I hope I have the numbers correct. 32 wins in 42 Formula 4 starts. But what is talked about more is your accident and walking out of the hospital. Can you give us a first-hand account of this, please? And I've read this so many times, and this is a very inspiring story, I must say.
Yeah, it's a crazy situation. I think you're alluding to the accident I had when I broke my neck. And it's a very serious accident. I damaged the third, fourth, and fifth vertebrae in my neck, and for a time I couldn't feel my arms or my legs, and I was very upset. Some of the feeling came back, and I discharged myself after a week. I traveled to another hospital and saw a very good specialist, and he said, did I ever want to walk again, and if I did I want to live? Because he took x-rays and then asked me if he could take extra x-rays, because he's never photographed a living person with the injury that I had. Normally they would be dead. And it was a very worrying time, but a time whereby, you know, when you're young, you heal quickly. I had tremendous determination, and fortunately, a number of weeks, a couple of months later, I was out racing again in a collar which I used for my whole career.
Incredible. You know, every time I read that, it's just like, wow, so inspiring. You and your wife, Roseanne, sold your house to go Formula 3. How important was the support from your wife in the success of your career?
Well, first of all, it was the dumbest thing I've ever done, to sell a house to go racing, because within 4 weeks, the money was spent and we got fired from the team, so that was a waste of time. But my wife has been the best thing I've ever done in my life. With her support and her friendship and encouragement, we've obviously gone through many challenges, and here we are now revisiting those challenges with my sons, and it's quite a deja vu, really. She's been totally instrumental in my career and my success, and basically giving me the strength sometimes to continue where maybe I would have thought twice.
Now, was she more nervous seeing her husband race or with the kids?
I think she does very well with watching her sons. Better than watching me, although if she had a choice, she'd prefer to not watch at all. But she's a wonderful lady.
You know, before we talk about your time in Formula One, looking back at your own experience, all the ups and downs, what advice will you give to young drivers who have aspirations to get into Formula One?
Well, two things. You know, to be a great race car driver, you've got to have a lobotomy. Because if you had a brain, you'd do something else. It's very tough to be a race car driver, I think. I think tougher now, because the finances required to go motor racing properly is enormous. The technology has moved forward, which, you know, in some areas it makes it easier if you have the money and the technology to help you do the job. But the best advice I can give is that follow your heart. And if your heart, with whatever sport you really want to do, if you live, breathe, eat and sleep it, and you're committed enough, then, you know, and you have the talent, then you'll win through eventually. But you got to remember, in motorsport, I think it's one of the toughest sports in the world, with 98% lows and 2% highs, and you know, it's just it's a tough campaign.
Colin Chapman, an amazing force in Formula One, gave you testing opportunity with his team in 1980, and I hear you did the test after taking painkilling injection. Can you fill us on this, please?
Yeah, I mean, timing is everything, and I had a very serious accident at Alton Park on September the 19th, I think it was, 1979, and I somersaulted at 165 miles an hour and landed upside down on my back. And it broke my back, my lower lumbar spine. And then, would you believe, a week later,
folks, that was Nigel Mansell, not me.
A week later, I got a cup of tea coming. A week later, I had a phone call from Colin Chapman, and they said, oh, you know, we have an opportunity if you'd like to make up the sixth test driver down at Paul Ricard, can you be there next week? And I said, yeah, I can. He said, oh, I understood you had a bit of an accident, you're right. And I said, oh, I'm fine. And I was lying on a board in my bed with a broken back. So I called my specialist up and I said, look, I know what you're going to say, but I said, I got a chance to drive a Formula One car in a week's time. I said, you got to help me. I said, whatever you got to do, I'll do it, but I've got to have painkillers, I've got to have a steel corset. And he fitted me with a steel corset and gave me the most strongest painkillers so I could actually go down and drive a Formula One car.
Wow. Your Grand Prix debut was in a very beautiful place, Österreichring, but was again a painful experience. When did the fuel start leaking into the cockpit?
It was before the start of the race, and I was sitting on the grid and I was getting a sensation of burning in the car, and I couldn't understand why. I felt my buttocks being burned. And then they smelt in the car, because I said I'm being burnt, and fuel was leaking out the tank. And so I was sitting in a puddle of fuel. So what they did, they poured 2 gallons of water in the cockpit to dilute it all. And of course that was great until it all drained off. And then after the start of the race, within about 5 to 10 laps in the race, the burning came back and I was being chemically burnt by the fuel, because obviously it was still leaking. I did, I think, 42 laps before the engine blew up, and I had third-degree burns. I had to go to the hospital to have them de-roofed, and it's very painful.
What a way to make your Grand Prix start, huh? Okay, how important was Colin Chapman in your career?
Totally. Without Colin, I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have been a world champion, and I wouldn't have been able to consolidate my position in Formula One. Colin was a most charismatic, the charisma of the man, he was an entrepreneur, he was a mega designer, he was just awesome. He was one of a few. There's only a few of them. Enzo Ferrari, Colin Chapman, they are just icons in the industry, and very few people come close to their reputation.
As I was telling you earlier, I was at Monza in 1982, September, and I saw him in his motorhome, just profile of the man. And I said, man, that's, there's only two people in motor racing who've done that nobody can ever do, Enzo Ferrari and Colin Chapman. What about your relationship with Peter Ward, the team manager there?
Yeah, I think it was very, very difficult for him to follow in the footsteps of Colin Chapman. He tried to do it the way Colin would do it, and I think that was a mistake. He should have done it his way, and then people would have respected that a little bit more. But he tried to dress like Colin, tried to impersonate Colin, and that was a wrong thing to do. And my relationship with him, as with a number of other people, were very delicate at that time.
Well, him throwing the cap, I have never seen that. It would never be the same.
Well, that you just alluded to something there. It was something that only Colin could do and would do. And but people do crazy things.
Dallas 1984, if I'm not mistaken, this was your first pole position in Formula One. What happened there? You pushing your car, collapsing. How do you remember that day, and was that your least favorite Grand Prix venue?
No, Dallas, I think, was fantastic. It's just that it was so hot and the track was breaking up. My car broke down coming across the line, and we worked so hard, and we were in the lead for a long time. And then second, and I just wanted to finish the race and get some points. If you got points, you got paid more money. So I got out of the car and pushed it over. I think I finished fifth in the end by pushing the car over the line. And then the lights went out. I don't remember anything else, because obviously my temperature got up to about 105, and I passed out. And all I remember is waking up on a bed of ice and in the nude, and I was thinking, what the hell is going on here? I've been kidnapped by some vampires. And I remember waking up with the most almighty headache. It was an amazing experience, one not to be repeated.
Yeah. Okay, how special was winning your first Formula One race on your home soil, Brands Hatch?
Very, very special moment in 1985. And, it's very satisfying. And to have the first win in your home country, and then another 4 wins. I won 5 Grand Prix in England, and that was fantastic.
Spain 1986, Tio Pepe, you and Senna cockpit to cockpit to the finish line. Your thoughts on that great finish?
It was a great finish, and I thought I'd won the race, but unbeknown to me, they moved the actual finish line closer down the track, and I don't know why they did that, but they moved the finish line from where it had been all weekend, and I'm not sure they could do that. Although the FIA obviously think they can do anything. But so when we passed the finish line that we qualified the day before, I was in front, but then moving the finish line forward, Ayrton was just a few inches in front, so a very close race.
Now, like I said to you earlier, you know, every time I'm talking to my racing friends and your name comes up, I always say this thing, only man, only driver who gave Senna a run for the money. You guys had such monumental battles, you know, Spain and Monaco. Did you get to know him a little bit off the track?
Yeah, no, Ayrton and I, in the later years, we had utmost respect for one another because he knew I was the only person he couldn't intimidate. And he knew I was as crazy as he was. And so you had to get a healthy respect. Otherwise, you can't race that close and not have an accident all the time. So we got on very well at the end, and it was a sad, sad day for motorsport worldwide, and especially for me, because most of my race wins, Ayrton was second, and a lot of his race wins, I was second to him. So we took a lot of race wins off one another, and there was a big void when Ayrton died, and it was a big shock to the racing world.
1986 season finale in Australia. The world was watching when you had a tire failure. A question, was there any communication with the team prior to that to come in and get fresh rubber?
Well, no, it was quite the opposite. The team said, stay out, the tires are fine. I actually radioed to say I was coming in for fresh tires, and they said no. They just checked Nelson's tires, and they were fine. But, no, sadly, everybody saw what happened. The tire exploded, and with that, the 1986 World Championship went too.
Does that remain the biggest disappointment of your racing career?
No, not really. I mean, it was the most spectacular disappointment that everybody shared with me. But, you know, I was three times runner-up in the World Championship, so, if you like, I had three disappointments. But that was the big one in 86 to get over, losing the World Championship by 1 point, and in a way whereby everyone saw it wasn't your fault. That was the only great thing about it.
Did you say anything, or curious what Frank Williams and Patrick Head had to say when you made it back to the garage?
No, I don't think I spoke to anybody.
Were you upset with them?
No, I wasn't upset with anyone in particular. I was just shell-shocked and numb that, you know, there we were with a 40-second lead over the fourth position. All I had to do was finish third. There was only 18 laps to go, and I was just, you know, taking it easy coming home, but unfortunately it wasn't to be.
1987 British Grand Prix. Okay, you were interviewed by Dave Despain on Speed TV, and you said this, that you made that great pass on Piquet against team orders. First of all, your thoughts on that pass, and how does that move stand in terms of your achievements?
It's one of the best moves because, I mean, we had to pick up a deficit of 24 seconds over about 20 laps, and we only had probably one chance to do the manoeuvre because Nelson is very revered. He's a great world champion, and, you know, he's not easy to pass. But I set him up going down Hanger Straight. I did a dummy to the left and then jink to the right, and managed to get alongside, and we touched going into Stowe pretty much flat out. And but, you know, I won the race with no fuel, and the engine blew up on the slowdown lap. So it was a most perfect ending to a British weekend with winning the race.
If I may ask, you know, your rivalry with Nelson Piquet was, you know, very intense on the track, just like with Senna, but he was even totally out of control in terms of verbal abuse, if I may say. What triggered that?
Well, I don't think it's anything personal. He uses anything in the book and his arsenal to upset people. He's done it with Prost, he's done it with Ayrton, certainly done it with me. And, you know, there's no holds barred. He says the most outrageous things about your family, your wife, your children, you, anybody else, if he thinks it will destabilize you in any way. But it didn't bother me because I just feel people who do that show themselves up.
Did Frank Williams or Patrick Head ever try to talk to him to cool down?
I don't think anybody could reason, you know, with people like that. When they say and do things like that, it's just a great shame. I think it's just a bit of a character flaw. I think it's a misjudgment on their part, because for me, Nelson's better than that. He doesn't have to do that.
Exactly.
You know, he's a great world champion, and he doesn't have to do things like that.
Thanks, Nige for that outstanding interview. Part two next week.
That's it, Nas. Keep up the good work. I want to thank everybody who listens. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I'm sorry, so sorry. Love could be so cruel. Oh, 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 yes. You tell me mistakes are part of being young, but I don't right the wrong that been done.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
So sorry.
So sorry. Please accept my apology. But love is blind, and I was too blind to see. And I was too blind to